Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I don't know about you, but I'll never be able to hear clips like this one without picturing my guest on today's show.
And I tested very positively in another sense. So negative. This morning, yeah, I tested positively toward negative, right? So, no, I tested perfectly this morning. Meaning I tested negative.
This is The Last Laugh. I'm Matt Wilstein from The Daily Beast, and it's finally happening. Today is Donald Trump's last full day in office, and Sarah Cooper is here. I've been wanting to have Sarah on the podcast for a while now, and for some reason, this week just seemed like the perfect timing. If you're listening to this, I'm sure you are familiar with Sarah, who really came out of nowhere last spring to become one of the most significant political comedy voices of the Trump era, without using her actual voice. Her hilarious lip-sync videos of Trump's most absurd moments have racked up millions and millions of views on TikTok, Twitter, and Instagram. And last October, just a week before the 2020 election, she released a wildly ambitious, star-studded Netflix special called Everything's Fine. That special offered some hints about where her comedy might be headed post-Trump, and she shared more details about what's to come in this conversation. We also talked about how she got here, the surreal experience of becoming super famous during a pandemic, and a lot more. All right, here's me with Sarah Cooper.
Okay, we're recording.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for doing this. I've been wanting to have you on for a while, and I'm really excited that we're doing it now because as people are hearing this, it's Donald Trump's last full day in office, which is really a long time coming. So how are you feeling now that this is really coming to an end?
I'm really excited. I'm really happy. And, you know, there's still a part of me that's like, is it really over? Could it really be over?
I know, right?
I said a while ago that I won't be able to breathe a sigh of relief until Biden has his hand on the Bible. And I still feel that way, but I'm feeling more hopeful than I did before. I mean, even after he won and it was announced that he won, I was still like, I don't know. They might try to pull, you know, something might happen. And for a while, I was still very scared, but I'm getting less scared every day.
So the reports are that he's going to leave Washington on Wednesday morning before the inauguration. Obviously, he's not going to the inauguration. Do you have sort of a farewell message to Trump on his way out of town?
What a petty bitch. That is all I have to say. What a petty bitch. Like, you can't even shake the man's hand. I mean, come on. I mean, it's so on brand, though. It's so on brand.
It really is.
I mean, it really is. Like, if he had been gracious and conceited and been, you know, this amazing beacon of, you know, light at the end of his term, we would have been like, wait, he did pivot, you know, but he never pivoted. So I'm happy he never pivoted.
There was never a new tone.
Nope, never a new tone.
There's still, even though people are still saying it on cable news, still giving him the new tone stuff. What have you kind of made of this past week or so? You know, I mean, I guess starting with the Capitol riot, but there's been this reckoning. I mean, he didn't change, but there has been some change in the sense that Republicans speaking out against him, Twitter, you know, deleting his account, all this stuff that didn't really seem possible a couple of weeks ago. I mean, what's been your reaction to that?
Yeah, I mean, the deleting Twitter, I didn't think they would ever do that. And I saw an image with all of the social networks that have banned him, and it was like Pinterest, and, you know, like all of these.
You didn't even know he was on. Yeah.
Didn't even realize he was using Pinterest to help, you know, promote himself, but obviously it makes sense. I guess cynically, I think, why now? You know, because he had been promoting so much hatred and violence for so long.
Feels a little
late.
And
so it feels a little late. It feels that, you know, cynically, I'm like, oh, they felt like maybe they were going to be exposed if any more violence happened, or they know that Democrats are coming in and they're going to be in charge now. So they're trying to curry favor with Democrats, you know. So, but for whatever the reason, I think it was definitely the best. I can't imagine right now if he was on Twitter. So many things have been like, well, if he was on Twitter, he'd be responding to this. If he was on Twitter, he'd be saying this. So we can all kind of imagine it. We don't need it. You know what I mean? It's great. We actually know exactly he'd be doing these midnight tweets. We'd be engaged with them. We'd be like talking about them. And just to take him out of the cycle that way has been awesome. It's almost like we've regained our sense of self by not having to watch this Twitter feed.
What's been really interesting to me is that even I think it's played a bigger role than I even expected it would in the way that Republicans are speaking out against him. Like, would someone like Liz Cheney have been as strong as she would if she had could have gotten a tweet, but she knew that there was no tweet coming her way. And apparently that's all they care about.
I never bought into this whole, they're scared of a mean tweet. Did you ever buy into that?
Well, I didn't really either, but now all of a sudden I'm like, maybe it is because now they're speaking out in a way that knowing that the mean tweet's not coming has sort of liberated some of them in a way that is unexpected.
Right. Yeah. The amount of power that Twitter feed had, it was, I mean, I knew it from the beginning. I wrote this rant that I ended up deleting the day after he was elected about how I knew that these tweets were going to be, every single tweet was going to be a headline. Every single tweet, there were going to be 100 articles written about it. And that's kind of what happened. And that vortex, I'm just happy for that vortex to be gone.
Well, you've been liberated from Trump's tweets for quite a while now, because he blocked you, what, 4 years ago?
Yeah. He blocked me in 2017, but I still, I had another account that I would like go in and I would look at what he would say. And it feels so good to not do that anymore.
When people hear that he blocked you, I mean, they assume that it's because of your videos, but this was like way before that, right?
Exactly. Yeah. I was on his shit list from day one almost. Yeah.
What did you do?
I was a reply guy. I was a presidential reply guy, I guess. You know, I would reply to all of his tweets, and I said something about how he, you know, it was like fake news. Donald Trump is not fit for president. Real news. Donald Trump was never fit for president. It was like so innocuous. It wasn't even funny. But people are starting to retweet it and like it. And I think that's why he saw it. And I think that's why I got blocked. But it was like shocking to go to his page and be like, Donald Trump has blocked you. Me?
What? Yeah. That is crazy. And there's been like lawsuits and stuff about it. I think that like, whether it's legal for the president to block people from hearing what he's saying. I don't know if you were part of those class actions, but
I wasn't, but it was pretty cool to go to his page and it actually didn't say I was blocked anymore. It just said this account does not exist.
I've been blocked by Eric Trump and Alec Baldwin. So that's where I am.
Wow. That's an interesting pair.
Yeah. So, you know, but still, I was able to see Trump's tweets.
What got you blocked by Alec Baldwin?
You know, I think I was critical of his Trump impression somewhere along the way. So he didn't like that.
Very sensitive.
Yeah. Very sensitive.
I was blocked by Geraldo Rivera.
Oh, that's a good one.
And who's the religious guy? The guy who was involved with his pool boy.
Oh, Jerry Falwell?
Yeah, I was blocked by him.
Those are good badges of honor, I think.
Yeah.
So Trump is out of here, you know, tomorrow, as people are hearing this, out of Washington, out of the presidency. What do you think should happen to him? Do you have predictions of what his future might look like in these coming months and years?
I don't know. It's like you don't want to be too greedy about what could happen to him. You know, I don't think he'll ever be in prison. I don't think he'll ever see inside a prison cell. I don't think he will. If Don Jr. goes to prison, that would be icing on the cake for me.
Nice.
I mean, at least rehab, right?
Yeah, something. One of the two.
He needs to go somewhere.
He needs to be locked in some building somewhere.
Yeah, I think that, no, so he's in a lot of financial trouble, and I do think he's going to be investigated. He's going to be hanging out in Mar-a-Lago. He's not allowed to live there, so I don't know how they're going to let him live there, but I guess they're going to like do a loophole or something.
Yeah, he breaks every other law, so what's different about this? Yeah.
Is he going to be back on Twitter? Will he get back on? Will we see post-election Trump on Twitter where he just rants about stuff and then we ignore it, or will we pay attention to it? I don't know.
Back to old school Trump on Twitter where he was tweeting about the Oscars and, you know, stuff like that.
Right. I mean, Do you think he's going to run in 2024? I just don't know. Like,
I was hoping that they would figure out a way to bar him from doing that, but I'm not super hopeful about that either at this point, now that it's getting pushed.
This isn't what I want to happen, but I think what will happen is that he will continue to be in the public eye. He will push his children. He will hope to have some sway over the Republican Party in 2024, I mean, 2022. And maybe he's going to have get back at people who went against him. You know, maybe he'll still want to do that, or he'll completely lose interest in politics altogether and just go straight back into entertainment. And maybe they put him on. Would they put him on Dancing with the Stars?
I think they would. I think they have very low standards over there. So.
They have such low. You know what? At least the Masked Dancer. He would be on the Masked Dancer.
That would be good. Yeah. Sarah Palin was on the Masked Singer, so he could one-up her by going on the Masked Dancer, which would be good. What about comedy post-Trump? I mean, that's been a big, conversation about. It's been a conversation during Trump is Trump good for comedy? Is he bad for comedy? And there's a lot of articles about that. I'm curious about sort of what happens now. I mean, are there things that are funny to you about the Biden-Harris administration, or do we not know yet? Or how are you feeling about political comedy over these next 4 years?
Such a good question. I'm on board with the people who want politics to be boring again. And so I think that we have oversaturated the market in terms of political comedy. And I think that we need to make fun of other things now. And I think people are going to want to talk about other things now. And I think people are going to want more of an escape from, because this pandemic isn't over. There's a lot of capitalism is still destroying the country. You know, there's a lot of things still wrong. So I feel like people are going to want more of an escape. I think absurdist, surprising things that, I always say that we're going to have to come up with something funnier than Four Seasons Total Landscaping.
That's the hard part, right? Funnier than reality. I mean,
exactly. And I feel like to be funnier than that, you need to go not A to B to C, you have to go A to X, it has to be things that just shock you and surprise you. And like WandaVision looks really good to me. I haven't seen it yet, but that just, it looks so bizarre. And I'm like, I want bizarre. That's what I want.
Yeah. It's funny. You're talking about, the Four Seasons Total Landscaping and these examples of things that are so funny, that are real, that have actually happened, and that satire and parody have kind of struggled to be funnier than reality. And I think that's really what you hit on with your videos, is that you didn't try to, probably one of the things that Alec Baldwin was mad about me writing at some point was that what SNL does in a lot of cases is they just kind of tweak it. They make it a little bit, crazier, but not that much. And so it's kind of recreating it, kind of not. And you're kind of just this was funnier when I just watched it yesterday in real life. What you did is really turn that on its head by using the actual audio, but adding to it in a different way. So is that something that you thought about? I mean, when you were starting to make these videos, that you were doing it in a different way than we've seen?
I didn't really think about it as a Trump impression ever. I really thought about it more as I'm not trying to be Trump, but I'm wondering what if Trump was me? I'm trying to embody this rich white guy that I could never be. It's kind of weird because you're saying with Saturday Night Live, a lot of those cold opens, they really don't change very much. They're almost recreating it. Even the visuals are very hey, let's create it exactly. And I feel like I took all the work out of that because I basically just exactly used the exact clip. I didn't think about it at the time that I was doing that. I was really just bored. And I was I would like to pretend that I'm as powerful. And I would like to pretend I think I am as smart as Trump thinks he is. I would love to have that level of confidence in everything that I'm saying. And I think that's why it kind of worked. I think it also just turned into this sort of news source for people because they were actually able to hear what he was saying without having to see his face. And so a lot of people were like, well, I can't watch him say this, but I could watch you lip sync it for some reason. And so it took on this sort of news quality as well.
Yeah, it really hit with the people who hate Trump, don't want to look at him, don't really want to hear what he's saying, but you made it palatable for them in a strange way.
Yeah, exactly.
Where were you in your life when you did the first video? Sort of where were your thoughts about comedy? Where were you in your, in your career when you decided to start doing this?
I was hosting open mics and I was working on my next book and lockdown happened, all the mics canceled, shows canceled. I should have been just focusing on my book, but I was I wanted to make videos. I was kind of really intrigued by a lot of people using Instagram for video. And I was like, you know, I'd like to build my following and maybe create some kind of series. Cause I'm used to creating like one-off videos, but I always admire people that can come up with an idea that like has legs beyond just one thing. And so that's kind of what I was experimenting with. I tried doing like news from quarantine. I did a little skit about that. I did a little like reenactment of a press conference with like my dog playing Dr. Fauci. Like I was just playing around with like anything that I could do. And TikTok, everybody was on TikTok, and my nephews had showed it to me like the summer before. And so I was playing around with a bunch of different things on there. And yeah, I mean, it was really just experimenting and seeing what people liked, and really the low expectation of production value that everyone had, because everyone knew that you're just at home. You could only work with what you had. And so I felt like that worked in my favor. It worked in my favor that people were like looking for things to watch and looking for things to talk about. And then it worked in my favor when he gave me the perfect 60-second clip where he was talking about injecting, you know, Lysol into your veins, like really just, you know, a brilliant comedy piece. And without realizing it, it was absolutely brilliant. The way that he's talking about it and then like looking for other people to like back him up and like, we're going to check that, right? We're going to test that, right? And I listened to it and I just saw the other people in the room being like talking about, you know, but nobody did that. And I think that was the thing that was so frustrating. It was like, he is saying crazy things right now. Why are scientists, doctors, why is no one being like, sir, actually, no, you're wrong. Why is no one saying that, you know?
And that's sort of when you imagine like if someone who looked like you was saying it, they might get a different reaction.
Right, exactly. And I liked being that reaction person of just being like, what?
So that was the one that, was that the one that really took off the most, the first one, the injecting bleach?
Yeah, I'd try a few others before that, but that was the one that took off, yeah.
Were you surprised by the reaction that it got? I mean, it kind of is insane when looking back that it blew up to the degree that it did. I mean,
yeah. Yeah. I was very surprised. I mean, it's one thing to have it go viral. I mean, I've had things go viral before. It's one thing to have something go viral. It's another thing to have like your career take off because of something like that, which is really what happened to me last year. I got an agent, I got PR, I got a Netflix special. I have like a TV show deal that I've been trying to sell based on a book I wrote a few years ago. I've been trying to do that for years. So like, it really brought me so much attention. Like other things can go viral, but it brought me attention and it gave me a platform of an audience that I never had before. And that I did not see coming. You know, I could see getting a few million views, but I didn't see it changing my life.
Was there a particularly surreal person who shared it or moment where you realized how big it was getting?
There were several moments. I mean, Jerry Seinfeld was definitely like the number one, you know, when he shared it. And then somebody said, Jerry Seinfeld's talking about you in a New York Times profile. And I said, Jerry Seinfeld's talking about me? And I still don't really know if he knows who I am, to be honest. Like, I'm a huge Seinfeld fan. Like, I fall asleep to it every night. So I know it inside and out. I'm a huge fan. And so for him to talk about me after me doing comedy for 10 years and nowhere near that level of recognition. And then to have that happen was amazing. Ben Stiller, every comment from Ben Stiller was just like, oh my, Ben Stiller's commenting, you know, Jane Lynch, Cher, Halle Berry, like pretty much every single person, was like a huge, like, wow. And I didn't even know how to respond, you know, because I'm not like, I don't like to make it seem like I'm showing off. So like,
yeah, like retweeting everything that someone says. About
you. I couldn't do that. Like, it's just, I have too much pride or I want people to think I have pride.
You
don't
be seen as like, you know, milking it.
Yeah, exactly.
The experience of becoming super famous during this year, during this pandemic where nothing is like happening in the world and you're not going out in the streets and meeting people, you're not going to Hollywood parties, you're not doing any of that stuff. I mean, what has that been like? It's like of all the times to become super famous, this is, I mean, you're one of the few people who actually did that this past year, you know, and it's very bizarre. I mean, what has that aspect of it been like for you?
I mean, I don't really feel like I'm super famous, first of all.
I think you are, first of all. I think everyone...
But why? I don't think I am, though. I really don't think I am. I don't. I mean, I get recognized here and there, but I, you know, maybe it is because there I have a mask on and all, and it's winter and stuff like that. But also, yeah, I haven't left my apartment. I did Fallon from my apartment. I did Ellen from my apartment. Yeah, you know, so I did crazy. All of these things sitting on my couch. Yeah. So
in any other year, it would have been so different. I mean, you would have been flying to LA right. and going on these shows, and you know, it just would right. have been a really different experience. Is there? Do you have? Do you feel conflicted about that, or is it just sort of what it is? Or
yeah, I think it is what it is. It's kind of like without Trump, without the pandemic, I wouldn't be talking to you. Like I wouldn't have had the success. So I just have to like accept that and know that. I mean, part of it is that I look at as kind of a blessing because I do feel like I need to separate myself a little bit from those impressions in order to have the career that I really do want to have. I feel like it was a great launching pad for me, but it's not something I want to do for the rest of my life. There's a lot of other things I want to talk about. So I feel like it's like actually kind of a good thing because now I can kind of be a little bit low key and focus on writing and focus on the next thing that I want to do versus if I had been everywhere and my face had been everywhere and I'd been kind of like sat oversaturated, I think that would have maybe not been great for the future of what I want to do next. So
I just got to see your clip of your stand-up that you put on YouTube, you know, I guess a few months ago.
Yeah.
And it was really funny. And I was really excited to see that because I just hadn't seen you perform stand-up before.
I was born in Jamaica. My whole family is Jamaican, and they make fun of me because I'm the least Jamaican one in the family. But I think it's their fault for naming me Sarah. Sarah is like the Karen of our generation, and she has moved in and gentrified my entire personality. Like, my mom would cook for me, and I'd be like, Mom, this jerk chicken is like really spicy. like next time, can you like make it without the seasoning? And she'd be like, Sierra, that's not jerk chicken, that's a piece of bread.
When did you first start doing comedy and what was that experience like for you? Because I know you sort of had this other career and then you shifted into doing comedy. So what made you make that decision and what has that been like for you?
Well, I wanted to be an actress when I was little. I wanted to be a singer, but then I was told that I couldn't sing. So then I was like, well, I'm going to act. I adapt. I'm like, okay, I can't sing. Let me act.
Yeah, okay. And then maybe I'll lip sync.
Great. <Yeah. laughs> You know, I can't write. I'm going to lip sync someone else's words. Yeah. I'll figure this out. Yeah. That's kind of how I've been. And so like after I turned 30, I wanted to like rediscover this childhood dream I had of acting. And so I started auditioning and, taking acting classes and I was not good. I was not good at it. And the one thing I hadn't tried was stand-up comedy. And I really tried it because I wanted to be comfortable with myself on stage and on camera and not feel like I had to be this perfect person, which is what I was doing. And so like stand-up was a way for me to like get on stage in front of an audience and just try to speak in my own voice and be as authentic as I could and hopefully take that authenticity to a role. But then I just found that I really liked saying what I wanted to say and, you know, performing it the way that I wanted to perform it.
Was there a first joke or bit that you felt like really worked or that really connected with people?
Yeah. Which actually might get me canceled today.
Oh, really?
This joke. Yeah.
What is it?
Do you want to hear it?
Yeah, I do.
Okay.
No, I definitely do.
Okay. So, all right. Please don't cancel me, you guys. This was 10 years ago.
Yeah, no. I think, well, it's on the record. It was 10 years ago.
Also, okay. So I say, I'm Black, in case you guys didn't know. I'm also a little scared of Black people. Anyone else? Like, get people in the audience to like see who was scared of Black people. And it would always be like a Black person who's like, yeah, I'm scared of Black people. And then I'd be like, you know, they're always like, you know, doing the Dougie all over the place and like making up nicknames for stuff like Cray Cray and Po-Po. And then I realized that Black people are just really drunk white people. You know, like I'm sure you've seen this before, like a white girl will go up to a bar and she'll get that really high pitched voice that all white girls get when they're asking for something. They'll be like, excuse me, could I get a margarita with salt? you didn't put any salt on my margarita. Could you put some salt on my margarita, please? Thank you. And then like six margaritas later, she's like, bitch, you better put some motherfucking salt on my margarita. So that's what I think people, white people really mean when they say they got so drunk, they blacked out.
That's
my
good.
Big punchline.
That's good, yeah.
But I did that joke once, like 5 years ago, and people were like, what do you mean? What do you mean, like, that black people are drunk white people? Like, that's offensive.
You can't say that.
And I was like, oh, I guess it is kind of offensive. But really, just the heart of the joke is just that white people are very repressed and they need to drink to dance. You know what I mean? A lot of times. And they need to drink to kind of like let loose. Whereas black people, for me, I'm not saying all black people, obviously, because I'm black and I'm very repressed myself. But what I've noticed is that a lot of black people are just more comfortable in their own skin and they're just more comfortable saying exactly what they mean and exactly how they feel instead of like couching it in all of this passive aggressive stuff that I think a lot of white people do. So that's like the basis of the joke, but I could see how it could be offensive to people.
Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, a lot of your stand-up, I mean, the most of the stuff that I've seen that you did really is about race and, you know, and sort of your own identity and how you, you know, struggle with that or how you think about it. And then I think there's been this whole conversation around your videos about race and gender in the sense of that you're, you know, sort of like the opposite of Trump and you're showing what it would be like for a woman of color to say the things he says and would never be able to get away with them. Do you buy into that? Is that something that you've agreed with the take on that of the videos?
Yeah. I mean, like, I'm sorry. I don't know if it's just Trump, but we're such visual creatures. We see a white guy who's looks like he's rich and he's speaking behind a podium and people are nodding and clapping. And we're like, okay, I guess this guy knows what he's doing. And I'm sorry. We just don't give the same benefit of the doubt to women or women of color, or we really are like, and that's the fucked up thing about these videos is that like, that's why you're listening harder is because of the visual. That's why you're listening a little bit closer. And so, yeah, no, I don't think that, I don't know if it's just Trump or if it's just like any, I don't think any white man could get away with what he got away with. But I think the fact that he was a white man, like helped him in many, many, many ways over the 74 years that he's been alive, you know?
Yeah. I'm wondering what that's going to mean for, you know, Vice President Kamala Harris in the way she's treated by the media, you know, over the next 4 years. And I think it'll be interesting to see the standard that she's held to compared to the standard that Trump was held to.
It's already hysterical. Fox News is already hysterical the way that they are like very seriously questioning, you know, policies and decisions and cabinet choice. And like, what are you talking about? You know what I mean? Like compared to what Trump was doing. And they were like, well, this is great. You know, he called in, he spoke to us for 2 hours. It's fine. You know, like, yeah. So until Kamala Harris calls into Fox News and speaks for 2 hours on a rant about yeah. nothing, like, I don't want to hear it. You
and
know,
they don't push back or challenge her on anything
yeah.
or question
yeah.
anything she says. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's not going to happen. I don't think.
No, it's not. She'd be fired immediately. Come on.
What do you feel like in that same vein of, you know, you listen to Trump, you know, obviously you've talked about, you listen to it over and over and over again and at high volumes and all that. What do you feel like you learned about him as a person by paying such close attention to him that maybe other people weren't getting?
I mean, I think that you and I and most people who saw the videos the way that I saw them, the way that you saw them got this, but I feel like his supporters still don't get it, that when he says something like, it's good for the country, or this is what the people want, or anytime he talks about anything external to him, he's talking about him. Like every single time, like I was listening to that Georgia phone call where he called the Secretary of State, and there's a point where he says, people hate Georgia. People hate the state of Georgia. People hate what's happening in Georgia. People? No, you hate it. You hate Georgia. So, I mean, he's just extremely self-obsessed. And I talked with Tony Adamunic about this as well, where, you know, he's speaking to himself, really. He's not listening to anyone else. Every time someone else is talking, he's not listening. But even when he's talking, he's listening to himself talk. He's telling a lie. He's hearing the lie. He's agreeing with the lie. He's reinforcing the lie. It's mm-hmm. this loop.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
a feedback loop between his voice and his head. And that's all it is.
You know, you mentioned his supporters the way they hear him. I mean, there's also been the way they hear and view your videos has come up a lot, in the sense that they aren't necessarily offended by them or outraged by them, and you don't
right.
necessarily get the
oh
kind
God.
Of hate mail that some people might expect that you would get. And it seems like they actually like them in some ways. Has that concerned you at all along the way, that they like your stuff?
It has been absolutely fascinating. I will say the number one most fascinating thing about the whole thing is that, can I curse on this?
Oh, yeah.
I'm sorry, I didn't
yeah,
even
yeah.
ask.
Yeah, yeah. Good. Curse away.
Yeah. No, I expected to be called a cunt like every single day after that video came out. I feel like I got called a cunt maybe twice.
That's it.
Like the whole year. I'm like, no, I really like, knock on wood, I got very little hate mail. Very little. And the hate mail I got was just like, this isn't funny. And I'm like, okay, you don't think it's funny. That's fine. You know, like, that's okay. You know, I feel like, yeah, it was good though, because I feel like I would have stopped. I mean, people think that I'm getting death threats. I'm not.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm like, thank God I'm not. It's not that I want death threats. It's just that I did expect them, because I've seen the wrath of the right, and I know what they can do. And I know that how they can like really make you feel like your life is in danger. And these videos, for whatever reason, did not ignite that. And I'm very happy about that. And a lot of people did say, yeah, I enjoy them. I love Trump, but this is funny. And so, like, what are you going to do?
Yeah. Even from Trump himself, who's been incredibly antagonistic, especially towards female comedians, when you think about, you know, Kathy Griffin and Samantha Bee and all these people that he's really gone after directly, he hasn't done that with you either. Even when asked directly about it, I think in August during an interview on Fox, he basically said he hadn't seen them, and, you know, he said, like, are they nice? And the guy said, not really. And but he didn't take the opportunity to attack you, as you may have expected.
Have you seen the videos that this comedian has been making, Sarah Cooper, where she takes your speeches and she performs them? I just wondered if you've seen that.
I have not, no. I'd like to see them. Are they good or bad?
I think you'd find them very entertaining.
Okay, good.
I think a lot of people would enjoy watching this person interview you, and their heads would explode, because she takes your voice and performs it.
I'd like to
see. And I was just curious whether you'd seen it.
I mean, if you say they're positive, I'd like to look. If they're not positive.
Well, she doesn't mean it to be positive.
I see.
But I think you might enjoy it.
Well, I'll have to check it out.
First of all, what was it like to watch the president of the United States get asked about you? And then what did you make of his response?
Oh, my God. It was so crazy. Like, that's the point where you're like, oh, shit. Like, I don't know if this is where I want to be. Like, you know what I mean? To have a reporter ask the president of the United States, have you seen these videos from Sarah Cooper? Like, just to even say my name, and my name was in his head for a second. Mm-hmm. Maybe, I don't know.
Hard to say.
I had people like texting me like, oh my God, they asked him about your videos. Can you believe the president of the United States is talking about you? Not really. He's just like, whatever. It was one of those moments where I was just like, maybe I've gone too far. But then it like completely blew over. No one ever talked about it again. And it just made me realize like, yeah, he's seen them and he hates them a lot. He hates them so much that he can't even rip them apart. Like that's how much he hates them.
Because they really, I mean, yeah, they expose him in a way that none of the other comedy about him really does, except for maybe Anthony Tamanic, and his stuff is pretty brutal too.
Right.
But
he hated him. He hated him too. But yeah, I mean, with this, I feel like this is me. Like, I'm not full of myself, but I do feel like they cut him a little bit deeper, just because it was his own voice, and I took away the thing that gave him all his power, which was the visual. He works very hard. I actually read an interview where it says he watches his interviews with the sound off, because he's very interested in how things look. And so his hand movements are very precise. Everything is in its place. He holds the Bible up the way that you're supposed to, where he thinks he's supposed to hold the Bible
upside
up,
down.
You know, upside down, whatever. But, and so for me to take that away, and put me on top of that, I feel like it was probably very disconcerting for him. But on top of that, I will also say, people were saying that I was the reason that he wanted to get rid of TikTok. I don't think I was the reason. I think it was the kids.
Yeah. The kids in the rally who sold all the tickets to his rally that people didn't show up.
I think that hurt him much deeper than my video about that rally. And yeah, so I feel like, I feel like he has so much going on. You know, he just for me to be like on like the top of his mind and like to want to destroy me, like I just feel like I'm number like 8,562 on the list of things that he needs to take care of in his life. So I feel good about that.
Coming up, how on earth did Sarah Cooper get Oscar winner Helen Mirren to recreate the Access Hollywood tape with her? And has she finally finished lip-syncing Trump for good?
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at UH1.com.
So I want to run through some of the sort of crazy highlights from this past year, sort of leading up to your Netflix special. But first, you mentioned, you know, doing the Tonight Show from your home, and that was your first late night show that you did, was with Jimmy Fallon, right?
And you
said to him at the top that you were that you'd been trying to get on as a stand up for a long time, and that you now were on from your couch.
And his response was like, "Cool."
Yeah, he was like, "Okay." what was that experience like for you of making your late night TV debut in such a strange way?
Oh, it was like really nerve-wracking because can I tell you something? I haven't even told anybody this. Like I said, I was working on a book, and in the proposal for this book, I was like, it would be great if for this chapter I could get an interview with Jimmy Fallon. And my editor was like, we can try. You know, and then 6 months later, I'm talking to him. So I'm like, oh my God. It was just a really exciting experience. They wanted to like have me debut one of the TikToks on the show. So I worked on that like all night because of course it had to be like as good as it possibly could be. And he was just like really chill and really easy to talk to. And I mean, I don't know. Those things go so fast. It's just like you prepare for ever and then it's 5 minutes and you're like, I didn't say half the shit I wanted to say, but it was fun, you know?
So cut to a couple months after that and you're guest hosting Jimmy Kimmel Live, which is not something I imagined you ever thought you'd be doing.
No.
So what was that like? And you're also doing it, I think you say from an empty mansion in somewhere and not in front of an audience, which is already telling jokes in front of nobody seems like one of the hardest things you can possibly do.
And yet that's what I was doing when I was doing open mics. It was all nobody.
So maybe you had a good experience.
I had a good experience with that. The hardest part was the teleprompter, because like when you're doing stand-up, you're not reading anything. In fact, if you read it, it's worse. And I feel like that hurt me a little bit because I was just really like, I don't want to read this, but then it's there. So obviously I'm going to read it, you know? So that was tough. And then the lip syncing, all the lip syncing I'd done before was me alone in my living room with my phone. And then to have a giant camera with like, you know, someone like doing like the wind effects for like one of them and like all of this happening, it was, and then knowing we had a certain amount of time to get it done and, you know, so that was tough. And then there was a weird thing with the earpiece, them doing the playback, and then there was a timing issue, so the lip sync was off. So then we had to like basically just do it the same way that I'd been doing it at home, just have the phone.
You guys, I got this. Like, I know how to do this.
Yeah, exactly. And then my monologue, I got a text in the middle of the night that was from my agent that was like, there's a 99% chance that you're going to be guest hosting Jimmy Kimmel. And I was like, no way. And I turned to my husband. And I was just like, I showed him the text. I was like, this isn't real. And I was thinking about turning it down because I was just like, I'm not ready. You know, I'm like not ready for this. And, you know, they were like, well, you know, maybe you'll get another chance next summer, maybe, you know. And I was just like, I can't turn it
down.
I can't say no. I have to do this. And so I met with the writers and I was like, I know I'm hosting, but I'm also like, this is also like my late night set that I've been working on forever. So they were really cool about like letting me do some of the material that I'd been hoping to do on late night. And yeah, Jesse McLaren came up with that ending piece where I was doing some, you know, lip syncing in response to viewer questions and stuff. And I took two mugs. Like, that's how excited I was. They wanted to give me one mug. I was like, I need two. Like, I got the shirt. Jimmy Kimmel texted me afterward and said, great job. And I was like, oh my God, Jimmy Kimmel is like, and then Fallon text, you know, messaged me and said that I did a great job. It was heaven. It was absolutely like, and I just got a picture actually from the executive producer with a note saying how great it was to have me on the show. This just happened a few weeks ago. And I look at the picture now and I feel bad because I don't really feel like I look like a host. I look like someone who's won a contest. that's what I look like. And that's how I felt. I felt like I'd won a contest. And so that's what I did. Yeah.
What's funny is you spent so long, you know, trying to like get to the point where you could do a stand-up set on late night. Not only are you now like guest hosting, but I think you've become too famous to do a stand-up set. Now you would just be the, you know, panel guest, like you're, you know. Which now you've done all. You did Colbert, you did Seth Meyers.
I know. That's like the fear that I did it all. And now what?
But maybe someone will have you on to do stand up when audiences are back. That would be great. Pretty cool.
Yeah, I was talking to my sister and I was like, I don't know. I think people are just going to kind of like forget about me and I don't know like what to do. And she's just like, just do another hosting gig. Do another. And I was just like, yeah, I'm just going to call up someone and be like, yeah, I'm going to host your show tonight. Thanks. You know, doesn't happen like that.
And then the other one that I wanted to ask you about was you did a video and an appearance at the DNC, which was must have been kind of insane as well. How did that happen? And what was the experience like of that one?
They approached me. They emailed me. They emailed my manager and asked me if I would do a lip sync. And I'll be honest, I knew everything was virtual. And so I assumed it would be an online virtual event. I had no idea it was primetime television. I had no clue.
Tens of millions of people, probably.
No, I had no clue. I was in LA just like getting ready to film the special. And they were like, we need this, we need this. I was thinking about like, do I have time to do this right now? I have so much going on. But I was like, no, I need to do this. This is really important. And I wanted to do it. So I recorded it, you know, at this Airbnb in LA and sent it off and thought, great, it'll be online. You know what I mean? Like that was my feeling. And then all of a sudden everyone's texting me like, you're going to be on the DNC. And I was like, yeah. Are you watching it on, you know, on Twitter
YouTube,
or something,
yeah.
You know? Yeah. But no, it was on prime time and I framed it wrong because I didn't realize there was going to be that lower third and stuff. So there's all this stuff that I wish I had done differently, but at the same time, it was such an awesome feeling to go from making like, you know, little kind of comedy skit things and growing my audience and like kind of turning that into something that contributed to something, you know, because that to me like made a difference for me. I feel like that's the pinnacle of doing something that you love that's fun, is that if you can do it and you can also help in some way, it just makes it so much better because then you don't feel so useless. You don't feel like so selfish that I'm just doing this for me. You're like, oh, I'm actually helping something, you know?
Will they be counterfeited by groups inside our nation? Will they be counterfeited maybe by the millions by foreign powers?
Let me put this in my own words. I've heard Donald Trump say some pretty unhinged things. I've heard them over and over and over again. But nothing is more dangerous to our democracy than his attacks on mail-in voting during a pandemic. Okay, here's the truth. Donald Trump doesn't want any of us to vote because he knows he can't win fair and square. So whether you plan to vote by mail or in person wearing your mask, it is your vote and it's your right. Don't let Donald Trump take that away from you.
So let's talk about the special for a little bit, which is just, it's really so much amazing stuff in this special. And I don't have any idea how you pulled it off in this time and in COVID and all of the guest stars and everything. So is this something that Netflix came to you and said, we want to do something with you, and it grew from there? Or how did it happen?
I was doing like a lot of general meetings. Do you know what general meetings?
Just like,
they're the worst.
Like someone, yeah, what can we do with you kind of thing? Yeah, or maybe.
Yeah,
or,
can you tell us who you are so that we can like figure out how we can, you know, sell you to somebody. No, I was very bad at general meetings. And then during this time, maybe the Zoom format is actually better for me because I feel a little less intimidated. But I met with a lot of different people. And one of the people that I was really excited to meet with was Maya Rudolph and Natasha Lyonne. And at that point, my agents were thinking about, you know, I was working on selling the books and turning them into TV shows, but these things take so long that I wanted to do something where I could do the lip syncs, but also do something else, and kind of just show people that I was more than just these lip syncs. So take that audience and like kind of convert them basically to like not just people who hate Trump, but people who like Sarah Cooper, you know? So that was kind of the tricky thing, because, you know, as much as people love the videos, I think a lot of that love is driven by the hatred of Trump. And so you don't really want, that's not really the kind of audience that's going to like span, like, you know, a lifetime. You really
want
to like build
that. Who just hate something. You want them to like you.
Yeah, exactly. You want them to like something. And so, when I met with Maya and Natasha, I kind of pitched them this idea of doing a special where I could do some of the lip syncs, but then also do some sketches and kind of make it sort of a variety kind of special. And they were like, yeah, let's do it. They didn't even think twice about it. It was really awesome. And pretty much from the day that I spoke to them through, I mean, I want to say like a few months ago, it was just like every day constant, like, what is this going to be? Like trying to come up with the idea, like putting together a pitch, pitching it to a bunch of different places. Netflix, you know, wanted to do it. And we wanted to do it with Netflix, and they wanted to do it. And so it really happened very quickly. And looking back, I think people, and me included, try so hard to figure out Hollywood and try so hard to figure out how you get something made. You know, how do you get yourself seen? And it just happened. Like, it really was just like, here's a pitch. Okay, let's shoot it. Here's a few million dollars. And I was, okay, like, we're just, Winona Ryder wants to be, okay, great. You know, it literally was just like everything fell into place. And, you know, it was a big kind of decision looking back. It didn't seem like a big decision at the time, but looking back, it was a big decision to not just be like, well, let me just do some stand up and, you know, maybe do a few sketches and maybe do, you know, take all of that and put it together. But I kind of wanted to tell a story. I kind of wanted to tell a little bit of a story, and I've always wanted to be sort of like a morning show host kind of person. And the one thing I always remembered from the night of Trump's election was Wolf Blitzer announcing that Trump had won with like the same voice, the same intonation as he announces everything.
He kills me. He uses the same voice. Like watching him cover the Capitol riot was the most disturbing thing to me, because it's literally the same tone for everything. You're so right. It's the weirdest thing.
Right. It's like the world is falling. Like literally aliens could land and Wolf Blitzer would be like, aliens have landed on planet. You know, like, it's just like, no, Wolf, we're going to die.
Oh, yeah.
So I wanted to do like a host who actually has that breakdown and actually has that moment of just like, no, everything is really fucked up, you know? And so that was kind of the concept of it. And I learned a lot. I'd been in one writer's room before this, and now I was sort of leading a writer's room and working with Maya and Natasha and Paula Pell and Cola Scola, who's I'm a huge fan of, and
incredible people that, I mean, both, yeah, behind the scenes and in it that you got.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah. And I'll be honest, I had no idea what I was doing. It was not only that I had no idea what I was doing, it was also that I was working with people that I'd never met before, you know, for a long time. It's very strange to have a project to deliver within a few months that you're making with people that you don't know. I mean, you can say whatever you want about how it turned out, but the fact that it even got done is a miracle. Yeah. So I'm happy with that, you know?
Well, I have to ask about the Access Hollywood sketch with Helen Mirren, which was just one of my absolute favorite things that I saw all year. And that's another one where I just have no idea how you pulled it off. So I just kind of want to know everything about how that happened. How did you get Helen Mirren, and what was the process of putting that together like?
I think Helen Mirren is such a badass. And I don't use that word because I feel like it's kind of cheesy, but she just is. And she just was like, we asked her to do it. And she was just like, Billy Bush. I think she literally was like, I'll never get asked again to play Billy Bush. It's not something that happens every day. And she was just like, I think she just saw the challenge of lip syncing this man and like trying to like do that. And she wanted that challenge, which was incredible because she's 70. And so I met with her on Zoom several times to rehearse. And I felt so stupid because she's Dame Helen Mirren and she's this award-winning, absolutely immaculate actress who has perfect control over every single part of her body and her voice and everything. And I'm like, here's how you lip sync Billy Bush.
You're teaching her. You're her masterclass teacher for this.
I felt like I was pulling talent away from her. You know, and I was like, no, let's get rid of that talent and let's make it sleazy. And she made it sleazy and it was awesome. And it was, she was like doing the towel thing, you know, like hitting me with the towel in the back of the bus. And anyway, I mean, we rehearsed and she got very good at it and she started having fun doing it too. And that was awesome.
You can tell, that there's a lot of fun in that sketch.
Yeah. I mean, and it was COVID too. And so we could only be on the bus for like 10 minutes at a time. And so we had it was a bus in the middle of this parking lot. We had speakers blasting the grabbing by the pussy audio as loud as it could go. So I don't know what everybody in the area was thinking. And they just played it on a loop over and over and over again, the same way that I was doing it with my phone, except this way was with like, you know, a camera crew and Natasha Lyonne directing. And
it's so good.
Polly Morgan, like, who's this amazing cinematographer, like pregnant, with a camera, you know, filming me and Helen Mirren, you know. It was fun.
Yeah, I mean, that felt like a pinnacle in a lot of ways of what you'd been doing up until that point, where it's like, it seemed like the best possible use of this technology and this idea to bring that particular piece of audio to life.
Exactly. Like, I couldn't finish this part of this Trump thing without doing that. And I'm glad I was able to do it that way.
It's been really fun too, watching you branch out beyond the lip syncs on even just on Twitter and on, you know, in your videos that you're putting out. The Jenna Ellis Law Mentor is one of my favorites.
Thank you.
Where did that come from? The idea to do that? And
I got to credit Blair Erskine. I think her name Erskine. I can't pronounce her last name, but she's awesome. And I just love the whole genre of front-facing, mostly improv, of external characters to a situation. And I think she does that really well. And so like, I was inspired by that. And I just thought, well, who is telling Jenna Ellis that this is a good idea? And so like, I came up with this, I'm Deb from the Clintalk. I'm the law mentor of Jenna Ellis Esquire. You know, it was just so much fun. I was just having fun with it. Yeah.
Hi there. My name is Deborah McClintock, and I am the mentor of Jenna Ellis. She is my mentee, and I thought I'd just make this video and kind of teach you what I taught her, because, you know, there's a bit of different philosophies with law when it comes to law, and I have a different philosophy is what I taught her. And I want to, you know, like, for example, with the evidence, you know, some people say, show your evidence. I say, don't show your evidence. Keep that to yourself. You know, keep that. That's for you. That's so you know that you have a case. You don't need to prove it to anyone else. Okay. That's for you.
Do you feel like, you mentioned that this, you know, this is, you want to move past this Trump stuff. You don't want that to define you. Do you feel like you're done with it for good now? Or is it over? Are you done lip syncing Trump?
Yeah. I mean, I talked to a friend about, you know, when should I stop doing it? And I was like, well, I should stop doing when people don't want it anymore, but no, I should stop doing it before people stop wanting it. You know, you don't want to keep doing it until people are like, please stop, you know? And I still have people with the Georgia phone call. They were like, please do the Georgia phone call. And I listened to the whole thing, and I probably should have just recorded myself, because as I'm listening to it, I'm mouthing the words, you know, and I'm like acting it out. And it was a lot of fun for me personally. Yeah. But
in terms of, didn't feel like you needed to be in the world.
No, I didn't. And I'm glad, because this is what happened with Trump, is like, that was crazy. But what happened 3 days later at the Capitol was even crazier. And so I just, yeah, we need to put this aside. And I'm very happy to move on from it. As fun as it was, and as much as there probably will be a moment in the future where I'm listening to him and I'm mouthing the words and thinking to myself, this would be a good video, I'm not. I'm probably not going to do it.
So we end every episode of the podcast by asking comedians, who is a comedian who has made you laugh really, really hard in your life? Who's someone who just stands out as one of the funniest people that you've ever watched or gotten to either interact with, or just someone that really makes you laugh?
I've never met her, but I'm a huge fan of Chelsea Peretti. She is someone who her voice makes me laugh.
She's so good.
I'm just a huge fan of hers. I like her mind as well. I like the things that she talks about. I mean, she made an album about coffee. I love that. I just love that. Like, she just does whatever she wants to do. And I'm a huge fan of hers.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for doing this. This was really, really fun. And I'm glad that we finally got to talk. And yeah, I'm just looking forward to everything that you do next.
Thank you so much, Matt. This was so much fun.
Thank you so much to Sarah Cooper for being my guest on this week's show. You can stream her special, Everything's Fine, on Netflix right now. And you should, of course, follow her on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok if you're not already. If you're enjoying The Last Laugh, please help us out by leaving a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. We want as many people to hear this show as possible, and you can help by spreading the word and sharing it with your friends. You can find me on Twitter at Matt Wilstein and at thedailybeast.com. And if you're not already, please follow at Last Laugh Pod on Instagram, where you can see photos and videos from all of our episodes. The Last Laugh is distributed by Acast for The Daily Beast, with audio production by Jesse Cannon. Our theme music is by Claude, who you can find on Instagram at claude.mp3. You can find this show every week on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, you can find show notes and highlights from each episode on thedailybeast.com. See you next week.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.